Just put up your finger.
Testing, testing. 1, 2, 3.
Okay, now.
We were talking about cypherines and being a slightly.
Yeah, the RT radio, the people who, or the girls who received the messages that came in from the field, very, very, you know, the connection was very strong because they'd set up these radios in the field, way out in the bush, way out in the jungle. The bit about the leeches and everything else was apparently quite true. They had some horrifying times, always terrified of being caught, always having to be very careful with their radio transmitters. So sometimes they would transmit something. I can remember at one point something coming through and we all hooted, you know. It came through marked, of course, you know, the usual top secret thing, and someone had transmitted through and it came rushing right into the cipher room, and I can remember grabbing it and sitting down and working out the code. That was a one-time pad. This particular one, they used the Typex when it really was very, you know, they didn't want anyone to break it in any way. Typex, very difficult to break. So we decoded it, and it said, 7 days without a bar of soap, BO very high. And, you know, we all just hooted because the sense of humor that the agent had was quite remarkable.
Would you have known the person transmitting that message? What I really want to ask is, if a group was being trained, let us say, to drop into Burma, would you, before that group went, as the receiver of the message in Calcutta, would you have sort of been introduced to that group and particularly to the wireless operator, so you might be able to recognize the handwriting of that particular operator? Not the handwriting, but you know the.
Yeah, you mean the style.
The style.
Yes. Because you see, it was very obvious. There we were all living in a compound together. And let's say that Harry and Ted and Peter were there, and we'd all gone to the 400 Club, for example, and we'd been dancing and we'd been having a hell of a time. And we knew that 2 or 3 days later they wouldn't be around. And then they'd come back again. Hopefully, God willing, they didn't always come back, but you know, 2 weeks, maybe 3 weeks, and they were back again. Some stayed in for much longer, but it was pretty hellish, so they didn't stay in for generally for more than that, except for one agent that we had in Rangoon who spent, I think, almost a year undercover there. I can't remember his name, but he was a quite remarkable man, very young as I remember. But he was somebody who spoke the language fluently, and he'd gone undercover, and he had a lot of Burma people who helped him. Now, the Burmese tended, for the most part, as you know, to side with the Japanese. They did not side with the Brits, but there were a group of them who were very solidly pro-British, and he had a lot of help. And he had all kinds of underwater equipment to blow up Jap ships, to cause havoc here and yon. He had a cache of stuff, if you like, in underneath a bungalow on the opposite side of the river, of the lake, I'm sorry, Lake Victoria, from the Schwedagon Pagoda. Because eventually when I got to Burma, I found him, and spent, in fact, a couple of days there, but then I'm going on in time a bit now, and saw this. And so we did have people who, well, he was one who was there a long time.
I suppose one of the, I'm trying, not having obviously been involved in anything like this myself, I'm trying to visualize a little bit more precisely what work was like in ciphering and so on. And I know what happened in Europe, for example, with the SOE people who were dropped into Europe, was that very often the person picking up the transmissions in wherever it was, in Baker Street or wherever they actually physically picked them up from a particular group in Europe, would have been introduced to the wireless operator and maybe would have been familiar before he actually went with his particular style. So that, in other words, it was easier for them. Let us suppose that the wireless operator was captured and turned around by the Germans. Now, there were security checks involved in the transmission of messages which were supposed to be picked up. But sometimes doubt would be cast on whether it was really X who was
mm-hmm.
transmitting.
Mm-hmm.
And the person receiving in Baker Street would say, oh yes, but I can recognize his style because they had been trained with the operator. Now, was that kind of security consideration, you know, security
procedure? Oh, I'm
sure
it was, yes. I think, it, again, as I said, that this would be with the RT operators.
Right.
And these were the people, yes. The girls there, even more than we had. You know, we didn't have, as I say, that direct link. We were the middleman, if you like.
Right.
But without us, you couldn't, again, get any sense. We were all a link in the chain, but the thing started, as you say, with the radio operator, and then with the operator at our end, and then coming into the cipher room. Nothing ever came over plain.
And most of it was one-time pad rather than Typex, was it?
No, there was a fair amount, you know, of Typex, because it was not... if they had the key, they could do it very easily. As long as they had the key for the day, they could. And then we'd have to pick it up and put on the, work the drums accordingly, and look through our books so that if it was the Queen of Spades or whatever it was, for, we'll say May the 14th. It all worked. I can't remember exactly how it worked, but I can remember at some time using the cards. The Queen of Spades or the Jack of Spades or whatever it was.
And what would the card exactly tell you?
Well, it wasn't a card. It was just on the book, you see. And you'd use a combination.
What would the Queen of Spades tell you, I mean?
Well, it would then mean that we would turn to such and such a page and we'd set the drums according to that page. And maybe it would be QS... WTV, there were five letters, WTV, and that would be the start of the code. You'd set your drums then, as far as I can remember, using the pinpoints on the side. You know, there's a sort of thing, it's very small little pinprick things, and the drums rotate there with these ratchets that you keep pulling over until you have all these letters in a row. Then there's something else you have to do, and I really can't remember what that is, but, you know, there's a series of steps that you take. Now, if the radio operator has, we'll say, taken down that very first thing, which is the setting, or some... one letter is wrong, then we'd just get gibberish. And that was where you really had to learn to be very careful, because, or at least very clever, if you like, because a number of us learned the trick of, I don't know what would happen. Sometimes it would click into your mind that, okay, W, all right, so you've got a W, and the W is coming out and it's all wrong. Now, it could be that they meant a V or an X. Those are either side, so you'd sort of start transposing and using these things. Okay, or if it was a V, you might think it, you might again think, well, they may do, you know, it may have come through incorrectly. It may be that they thought, thinking V, B, whatever. I mean, there were all kinds of things that you worked around. You weren't always successful, but 9 times out of 10, you could generally crack a code.
Did most of them get deciphered fairly quickly, or were
there
long
delays? Oh, yes. Oh, no. That was one thing that we had to be very, very good at. We had to be very quick, and I think the pressure was always on.
How many hours a day did you work? Could you work?
Oh, well, we worked sometimes... 9-10 hours. We'd stop maybe for half an hour.
How many of you would there be?
Usually 3 at a time. 3 on watch. Of course, we worked watches, you see, we worked at night as well. just work in the daytime.
And all women?
All women. Yes, that's interesting, really. We didn't have any men at all. All women. A small, very, very hot, because, it's a hot country. It was extremely hot, because we didn't have air conditioning. Just got used to it. You know.
Fans,
we had the punker wars, yes, we had the punkers that moved. But that was all. And we were a sort of little clan. There was the outside room with the radio operators, the inside room with the three cipher machines. And of course, if one broke down, we were in real trouble, because the three of us were kept very, very busy. We didn't just, of course, have material coming in from the field, you understand. We had material coming from the UK, we had material coming from Washington. And then, of course, the Americans came and joined us, too. And then again, we had some problems with the OSS.
Well, tell me about problems. Well, tell me about what happened when the Americans came. How did
we had two of them. Again, their total lack of understanding of security. They just weren't used to it. These were not people who'd been, we'll say, with OSS for years and years and years and years. These were new people. And quite often you'd find that, you'd be sitting, we'll say, at the Saturday Club, and one of them said, "See, the message came in last night." <It's horrible. laughs> After a bit, they learned to, shall we say, remain silent on these things, because we never talked shop, never talked about anything. When we were out, we had fun, but never talked about what went on or talked about life, love, sex, anything but shop. It was a very interesting time. And I would do it all over again if I had the chance, but not married.
Well, it doesn't sound in a way as though you were married in some way, because
right.
You didn't see your husband for several months.
That's right.
You said the last time we talked that one of the things you remember about this experience was really what it did for you as a woman.
Yes, well...
Could you say something about that, what it meant for you as a woman?
I think it meant a total freedom. A freedom for women that was no longer, that was really not in existence in those days. I mean, there's a lot of discussion today about women's freedom. Those of us who went into either the service or had a service or as a civilian was attached to a unit like Force 136 had a fantastic freedom. Not only a freedom to move around, to be what we wanted to be, but to be respected in what we were doing and to mix with men on a totally equal basis. If you were a WAF officer, you shared the mess with men. The other night, I went to a mess dinner given in for His Honor. And because I had been a WAF officer, I was one of the five women in the mess the other night. Wives were not allowed to go, but ex-officers were. So, what I'm saying is it carries all the way through your life. I have never, since that experience, been afraid to try anything. I never felt in any way subservient to any man. I have had, again, because of my experience and mixing with men, I have also a great deal of respect for a man, for the male, understanding the weaknesses that a male has as well as the weaknesses that a female has. That, the strengths and thing that everyone talks about and the putting down of women, I never found it. I think it has grown up in this day and age as a result of something that's been built into women who've never had the kind of experience I had. And I would suggest if they all went into the armed forces at some point, they might have a different point of view.
Can I just take you up on something there, just follow it up? What you're suggesting is that you didn't in fact encounter discrimination against you as a woman by men in the...
That's right.
In the Air Force as well as in Force
right.
136. And yet many of these men presumably had never before worked with women.
Quite right.
Why do you think this would be?
I think it's a consequence of war. I think it's a consequence of... really, it was an almost... There was no... In the working environment, there was no real sexual feeling at all. I guess we just didn't have time to think or feel like that. In some cases, you know, in the odd case, you had a woman who was an extremely sexual being and perhaps new to the job and trying to sort of use female wiles, if you like, to get or achieve something. Pretty soon that died away. We worked together on an equal footing, on an equal basis. And only perhaps when we took our uniform off occasionally, or even if we went out. I mean, it wasn't that love and romance didn't exist for us. It did, but not in the everyday workplace. We knew there was a job to be done. We were all very conscious of the fact that in England, originally, that we might be invaded. Later, when I was with Force 136, that it was a desperate situation for the Americans in that particular sphere, and it became a desperate situation for our own people who were in Burma, because they were getting slaughtered initially. It wasn't until Wingate went in and taught them about jungle warfare that, in fact, we began to suffer less casualties. All this was brought home to us because we were part and parcel of it. So we didn't really... men didn't have time to think about us in any other way other than comrades in arms. There was a camaraderie that existed, not only between the males, but between the males and the females who were working together. And I think it was a result of a common enemy. That's my own perception, anyway.
Were you ever, as part of your security training, warned against kind of sexual behavior as perhaps compromising to security? Were you ever specifically told about that or warned about it?
Only indicated to me when I married, and they were very upset about that. I mean, the thing was, they had hired me without a husband, and I suddenly acquired one. Now, the only reason that they were not too hard on me was the fact that I had married a military officer. I think had I met anyone on that ship, which was impossible since it was all military, but I mean, let us suppose or write a scenario that I had met a businessman and I had done this, I think that my contract would have been broken and I would have been told, you know, forget it. But I think the very fact that I had married a military officer, but I hardly saw him anyway, made things a little different. But that was the only time, and I realized it was because of the intimacy that would exist that they were perhaps afraid. But it wasn't until the end of the war that my husband was ever aware of what 136 was all about.
You didn't tell him?
No, I did not tell him. I didn't.
Did he ask?
No, he didn't. I guess, I don't know why, but I mean, he wasn't, you know, we saw one another very little anyway, and he didn't ask. And he knew that I wasn't with ENSA, that he knew.
You were in uniform?
No uniform.
You were not in uniform?
No, there was no uniform for Force 136.
So you didn't have any kind of cover? You could tell people you were in Force 136?
No, we said we were with the Ministry of Economic Warfare.
You were
still
with the Ministry of Economic Warfare?
Yes, the Ministry of Economic Warfare was just rather a joke to everybody. Nobody really knew what went on. It was very heavily guarded behind barbed wire. That I can remember. And the high iron gates and the whole bit. No.
Did any of the male officers wear uniforms, or did no one wear uniforms?
Occasionally the male officers wore uniform. We wore no uniforms at all. The women were, you know, just dressed, and I've got some photographs. You can see we had, you know, very thin summer dresses on because it was very hot all the time, and used to wear large straw hats. We became quite spoilt, you know, because we didn't have to do any work other than the work we were doing. I mean, domestically we became very spoilt because there was nothing that we had to do at all. There was a time when I got tired of living in the this is one time when I did get hell. I got tired of living in the compound. I moved to a bungalow of my own. I had sufficient funds to do this. And I was in there for 1 week only because I was hauled over the coals and told I was a bad security risk by reason of moving on my own and being wide open to anybody and anything. Now, I'd rented the bungalow, and I rented it on a monthly basis, so I lost some of the rent, but I had 1 week, and I was very glad to go back. It was a very terrifying week because I was there on my own in this bungalow. It was set in quite a sort of heavy, heavily... the garden was sort of a bit like a jungle. I was terrified of snakes, always have been. And I had this one rather scared little rabbit of a bearer with me. And so I wasn't sorry. When every noise at night, if I had to go off on night duty, you know, and leave there late, no.
Obviously, your experience living in this compound got a bit claustrophobic, which is why you left.
Oh, yes.
I imagine working, you know, with an organization like this could have its moments of exhilaration, as you've described, but also could be very pressurizing and claustrophobic. Can you talk at all about the kind of problems of working closely with other people in an organization like that?
I think mostly with women who, even the nicest, and I think I really shared that with the nicest, we all tended occasionally to be bitchy. I don't think, you know, the heat, the pressure, and, you know, would you swap a duty with me or something because I really, you know, I can't take it anymore. And we were never really allowed to be sick with headaches, you know. Sometimes we got, some of the girls got dysentery, and I was very fortunate, I didn't, and were quite sick. But they still had to come and report because we were so desperately short. So we shared that kind of thing, and we had a lot of sympathy if that happened. But it was, we were working very close quarters, everything. We went home and we shared a bungalow together. Now, we weren't all there at the same time. If we wanted to have a party, the four of us would have to share it. There were all these sort of little things that occur. For the most part, it wasn't too bad. It was just that occasionally it caught up with you. Circumstances, life, maybe you were in the middle of a love affair and didn't want to have people around you. I think it's one of the reasons why I moved out. And eventually Megan left and moved out with her Air Force squadron leader.
Was that frowned upon?
Oh, she left. She totally left the force because it was very frowned upon. But she was getting itchy. She didn't want to carry on anymore. Peggy, quite different. Peggy stayed because of Ted. This was the chap who'd come out from, I'm not sure if he came from Burma or Siam, I can't remember. Megan was replaced with somebody else, and then the end of the war came, or the end of the Japanese war, and we knew about this, you know.
So about how many months had you been involved, roughly, in
about
Calcutta?
A year. Mm-hmm. About a year.
And you knew in advance about the...
Yes, I suppose we knew about 24 hours before anybody else, anyway. It came through.
A hard secret to keep.
Oh, very hard, because none of us, of course, could go and celebrate or do anything. But we made plans to celebrate the next day. Force 136 was very efficient. Within a week, it was packing up, moving out, and we all had the opportunity then to sign up to go to Saigon. I didn't want to go to Saigon. We had had a...
They were going to send people, Force 136 were going to send people to
Saigon. Going to start up in Saigon. Now, I never...
What on earth were you going to do in Saigon?
Damned if I know, but something was still bad there. I think that we must have had Japs around there that were still not surrendered or whatever, but certainly we were going to have people go to Saigon. And a couple of our people. We had two girls whom I haven't mentioned, and they were both, they lived in a different bungalow. They rode around on a motorcycle all the time. One was called Lily, and she had long red hair. And the other one, I can't remember her name. But these two girls had also been undercover in France, and they had transferred out again. And they were not cipher officers. I'm sorry. They did something that was, I was never quite sure what, to be very honest. They were two of our very secret ladies, and yet they shared a lot of fun with us. We had a lot of fun with them. But they went into Saigon as a sort of advance force, and one of them came back with a bullet through her leg. I can't remember which one. And I know I was not at all impressed by the idea of signing up for Saigon. In any event, I thought, before I do anything else, I better go and find my husband, because Calcutta was shutting down. The place where I had moved out, because my husband had come back now to Calcutta, and although we were folding up with Force 136, I'd moved into a huge place where they had sort of small apartments, and we'd moved into one of these, but this place was also closing down because there were a couple of engineers and wives who had been running it, who were now going back to either where they come from, either Burma or they were going, no, we're going to Rhodesia, a couple of them. So they were closing up this place. My husband wasn't there. I moved to go and find him, and that was when I landed up in Chittagong, and I told you all this.
Right.
So, you know, as a woman, you couldn't really have any more adventures than that. And the Chittagong bit, and being on the ship there was the sort of the ultimate, if you like.
The ultimate epilogue.
Yes, it was. It was the ultimate epilogue. It did mean, it, you know, the meaning, or it meant to me that I went out with a bang instead of just a fizzle. Could have been very anticlimactic. It was. It was anticlimactic. The whole, even staying in India was anticlimactic.
You wanted to get out because of the anticlimax, this feeling of...
No, I didn't want to get out. I wanted to carry on.
I see. Right.
You see, it did
right.
That for you, too.
Mm-hmm.
But then you know of the number of men who came back, never readjusted. Now, one thing it did teach me was to adjust. After I had gone through that first 6 months after it was all over.
How did you feel during that 6 months? What kind of... What your emotional feelings?
It's a terrible thing to say, isn't it? You know, there was the end of a war and the end of the whole thing, and yet your emotions tell you that you've been on a real high for some years, and now there's nothing. Now, the year that I was a civilian, I felt the same way, you see, that there was nothing. Suddenly I was living in India, but I was what one might call a housewife. I had bearers and sweepers, and my husband was still with the Navy, and he stayed for many years, and we planned, in fact, to carry on living there. But then, of course, you know, there was the takeover by the Indians, and things changed a great deal. And, of course, I have a child who was born there. But generally speaking, there was that sort of letdown.
How long did that period of letdown last?
Oh, about six to eight months, and then I began to readjust and understand that, you know, this kind of thing has to happen in life. And what I felt, I think, as a woman at that time, was that I'd gone through a very exciting period that most women would never experience, and that I had to now settle down and learn to live in a new kind of world again. Being in India wasn't that bad. I managed to adjust. It was different again. I loved the life there. When we had to go home, then I had to start thinking again about another kind of life. And the first 2 years that we were back in the UK, I was not happy at all. There was a readjustment for everybody. But had I remained single, things would have been vastly different. I suspect if I'd remained single, I would have gone to Saigon, bullet or no bullet. But I wasn't single, and so I had to adjust to that. I had made a commitment, I had to stick with the commitment. I liked it or not. That was another thing. In those days, one didn't get married and then immediately think about divorce, because divorce was a nasty word and it didn't even exist in the British mind very much. So, one had to accept that.
Do you think that the wartime experience of marriage, separation and so on, that kind of thing, do you think that altered people's attitudes towards extramarital affairs, as they're so sinisterly known as? I mean, did that become more accepted, or was it even less acceptable? Because one felt a kind of loyalty to the other person involved in wartime.
No, more acceptable.
More acceptable, yeah.
Much more so, I think. I think that was probably the start, if you like, of the freedom that exists now.
I'm thinking like Brief Encounter, which obviously is talking about themes which must have been very important to people at that time.
It was. I think it was very hard. It was difficult, but it was being done. And I think that there is, here's something you really have to think about when you think about affairs during wartime. They were love affairs, and that was the difference. They were not the kind of affair where you just have a sexual affair. On the contrary, because of the loneliness of the person who was away from home, or just the fact that life was terribly dull, that love affairs grew up. And, there was a great deal of tragedy about this. It wasn't like having a sexual affair. It would have been so much better had it been that way. Because I think there was a lot of unhappiness. I think a lot of people married the wrong people. I think women and men married the wrong people. And then, out of a sense of loyalty, stayed that way. And then eventually, my age group, having reached suddenly a period where something that's happened, reached the age of about 45 and their children grown, were in a position where they could throw that away all of a sudden, because the morals of today had changed. That is about, if you're looking at 10 or 12, 15 years ago from now, had changed so much that it was accepted. And you could divorce without having any stigma attached to you. And that's why a number of people in my age bracket divorced. Now, there are a number of people who are still together, but you can tell just from being with them that it's more out of habit than love. It was just a sense of loyalty, but the affairs were there. But they very seldom culminated in a divorce. The man or the woman usually went back, because it wasn't done.